You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, the 10th of January. Continuing, I guess, you know, when you're in a bad streak, it just continues in terms of guests. Still trying to effort Tim Stanley, the British journalist and historian who we had originally hoped to have on the show Friday. We had some technical difficulties in making the Skype call, and we talked about him coming on the show this morning to talk about his experience seeing the Scorsese film Silence, which I'm just hoping against hope that's going to come out here soon in Central Kentucky. So we were going to talk about that. But so I messaged him last night, check in and see if we were still on, and I have not heard back. So there may be another issue. So just bear with me. I promise when we finally get Tim Stanley on the program, we will let you know. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Again, my question of the day, do you support or oppose right-to-work laws? You know, typically, predictably, I would say, if you're a Republican, you support right-to-work laws. If you are a Democrat, you oppose right-to-work laws. Because what you see... We got him on there. Oh, Tim, hello.
Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. Good.
I'm here. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing? Happy New Year.
I'm very well. Happy New Year. Happy New Year to all.
I'm glad we worked this out after our technical difficulties last Friday, so thanks for making time.
I'm very sorry about that.
Oh, no problem at all. The problem may well have been on our end. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, I've been looking so forward to seeing the Martin Scorsese film Silence. I asked for Christmas for the book. I'd not read the novel. I decided I want to read the novel before I see the movie. And so we got the novel, and it's just, I read it in about 2 days. It's compelling. It's been haunting me ever since. Still haven't seen the film, but I saw you had tweeted going to the film, and great tweet. You said, "The sobs you hear coming from the back row are mine." So let's talk about the film a little bit. Try not to give too many spoilers away. But what was it that you found so gripping?
I haven't read the book. I've only seen the film, and everyone I have spoken to has taken away something very different from it. What I felt was that this was a frank, painfully honest exploration of faith. It's important to bear in mind that it's about a very, very specific moment in time. I think it's the 17th century. It's Japan, during the period in which Christianity in Japan has been driven underground. And two priests travel to Japan to try to find a third priest who is rumored to have apostatized. And when they arrive in the middle of the most terrible persecution. And it's not giving the plot away, because this isn't the most important part of the plot, to say that they are caught and they are posed the choice of apostatizing or Japanese people will die. And that's the central moral tension. Now, it's very moving, partly because that's such a dreadful thing to have to face, and the agonies that they go through of trying to resolve that question are both physical and emotional. But it's also very moving because the film is an uncompromising representation of Catholic belief. And there are people in this film who are martyred for their faith without any doubt about their faith. There are people who serve their faith, as the Jesuits do, with this incredibly bold, masculine, honest and enthusiastic way. It's just simply the most exciting and, as I say, uncompromising representation of Catholicism that I've seen on screen ever, I think, ever.
Let's back up just a minute and talk about the persecution itself. You know, certainly the 16th century and 17th century, not difficult persecutions lots of places, including in your own native country. There were horrible persecutions. But usually we think of persecutions in terms of the situation of facing suffering yourself or denying the faith. Yeah, I think what made this different was this, you know, here's someone who is a spiritual father, a priest, a, you know, a shepherd of souls. They can audibly see and hear the suffering of Christian peasants. All he has to do is step on the fumier, the image, and deny the faith. And what's been surprising to me, Tim, is this sort of I've been surprised at the vigorous debate that I see happening among people of whether or not we can all say we don't know what we would do in those circumstances, right? But I've actually seen people argue that you should trample on the image in that circumstance. And boy, it's easy to say, I know, from the sort of safety of my speculative seat, but wow, I mean, it's hard for me to go there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I had an argument with a friend about the film. I urged him to go and see it, and he said it's a dreadful film. The film supports apostasy. The film is about giving in and giving up. And it was only about halfway through the conversation with my friend that I worked out he hadn't seen the film.
Wow.
And I got really angry with him because I said, you are telling me what I've just seen on the cinema screen. It is a very specific moral dilemma that they are posed. They are not being asked to give up their own faith and to avoid their own, in order to avoid their own martyrdom.
Right.
They're being asked to apostatize or other people will die. And some of those people who might die are people who themselves have apostatized. So they would be allowing people who don't even believe in Christ
right.
to die for Christ. So it's an incredibly complicated and specific thing. And it's not even clear, again, I don't want to go into it and give anything away, but it's not even clear that anyone does actually apostatize. I don't think you can judge what you would do in that situation. And to me, in a way, although that is the moral crux of the film, for me, the bigger portrayal of faith and the complexities of faith and the way it constantly forces us to ask ourselves why we're doing what we're doing and are we doing the right thing, the overall emotional experience of sitting through that and exploring that, to me, is actually more important than this rather narrow debate about whether or not they did the right thing. But certainly, I've been astonished by the number of people who told me with great certainty that they would never apostatize. And I hope it's true. I hope it's true. But I would never dare to say that about myself. And
yes.
I don't think most people who actually have been martyrs would have done either.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Who knows? And by the, you know, only by the grace of God. There are those who are calling this the most powerful Catholic film ever made. Would you concur with that?
Certainly in terms of films that I have seen, in terms of taste, I've always found the biblical epics, the 1950s with Charlton Heston and Choirs of Angels, I've always found them a little bit dry and uninvolving. I think for those who see faith as a complicated journey and full of stumbles and obstacles, I think this is perhaps the most involving film.
Mm.
It was very interesting in the cinema. A few people walked out. I think that's interesting. So here's a film which is capable of driving people away, and that means it's doing its job in some ways. Some people were clearly confused. Some people laughed in the wrong places. That might sound odd, but some people actually laughed in some places, I think because they found some of the faith on display a bit hysterical and ridiculous. But a lot of other people were crying along with me. I mean, I wept on three separate occasions. It was good enough. You know, my eyes dried and then it all started again. In terms of sheer power, and how extraordinary that a man who is not the most orthodox Catholic, perhaps not the most committed Catholic, although I don't know much about Scorsese personally, but it's not someone who has dedicated his life to the church. He works within Hollywood. He's produced films which are crass and violent and some of them quite unpleasant. How extraordinary that this man makes the film that the Catholic Church should have made years ago.
Well, it's not a stereotype, but if it's a movie that can make Brits cry, then we know it's got to be powerful.
Oh, yes, that means it's good, yes.
So one of the things you said on Twitter was, you know, that you had, it was the most, and you hinted at this already, that such a compelling vision of the priesthood. I mean, you said yourself, you know, you've been, you know, there have been those who've tried to plant seeds of vocations in your own mind and so forth. But this, for you, was the most compelling vision of what the priesthood is.
Absolutely, because it was full of the phrase, the urgency of the Gospels. It was full of the sense of something that you have to do, that is a compulsion. Rather than vocation, sometimes in Western societies, is explored in a very roundabout way. It's a little like, would you like to take up yoga? And it can be a little self-centered as well. Whereas the utter conviction of the Jesuit fathers, but more importantly, the thirst, the hunger of the people who they went to serve, is striking. And when they first arrive in the Japanese villages, the villagers throw themselves at their feet and demand that they hear their confessions. They desperately want to confess. They desperately want the sacraments. But also the Japanese peasants, obviously being left alone for a long time, have gotten a couple of points of doctrine wrong. So there's an important role of the priest when it comes to teaching as well. And most of all, it might sound strange to keep on coming back to this, but the masculinity of the priesthood is something that really comes across in the film. Mm. There are almost no female characters in it, except for one very important one at the end, which I won't give away. But women are not really present. And very often the church nowadays has become the mother church in more than just a metaphorical sense.
Hey, Tim, can you hold on through the break here for just a couple
absolutely.
Minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic.
Yes.
We'll be back in just a minute with Tim Stanley, British author, historian, journalist. We're going to talk a little bit more about the film Silence. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back in just a minute here on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Tuesday, the 10th of January, pleased to be joined from England, Tim Stanley. Tim, who is an historian, a journalist, an author, and appears on CNN, writes for the London Daily Telegraph. We're talking about the film Silence, which he saw actually on New Year's Day, tweeted about it, and having read the book and talked a lot about it a lot on the show, I thought it'd be great to talk about it with him a little bit more. We were talking a little off air, Tim, about I guess you could say that the Japanese inquisitors and those who implemented this systematic purge mm-hmm. of the Christian faith from Japan, which evidently initially the response to the missionary Saint Francis Xavier and others, there was a veritable explosion of the faith in Japan, really resonated at some level. But then when it became apparent there was this sort of interweaving of maybe colonial imperialism and the faith, they saw it as a threat to their culture, and they began to seek to systematically get rid of it, which I guess if you're going to try to get rid of Christianity, you couldn't do much better than the approach the Japanese took.
Absolutely, which is to discredit it, not to try to wipe it out, because the phrase comes up again and again that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, and it's absolutely true throughout the history of our faith. There have been attempts to impose Christianity on people, don't get me wrong, but it has advanced fastest and deepest when people have seen signs of the willingness of people to be like Christ and die for the faith. I think that's happening now, by the way. I think there is a revival going on in the West, and I think it's linked to people like Father Amel and to the massacres in Iraq. So the Japanese conclude, as the great realists they are, that it'd be much better to discredit the faith and to have the Jesuits admit that it's nonsense than to actually have anyone killed for it. So that's what they're trying to do. They're actually, in a perverse way, trying to avoid bloodshed. Killing people to force the Jesuits to recant is their way of avoiding bloodshed. There's a lot of class in the film as well. The Japanese are far more motivated by a hatred of the poor than they are necessarily the hatred of outsiders or of Christianity. But also that dynamic is one reason why you can watch this film as an atheist or a humanist or a secularist or whatever, and it'll have just as much of an impact, because it's about the necessity of conscience. It's about what happens when an individual refuses to give up believing something, and they collide with the state, which tries to compel them to stop thinking that thing. And you can watch this film even without religious belief, and you can see that in the ultimate analysis, a Jesuit's life without Christianity would be not worth living. And to apostatize is worse than physical death, because you would be left living for the rest of your life knowing you have betrayed something you believe in very strongly. And I think that could apply to Marxism, that could apply to liberalism, or any human creed. And for that reason, I think the film could and should be watched by people who are without faith, as well as those who are believers.
Hmm. One of the, I think, undercurrents, and this is, I'm speaking from the book, but I assume it's there in the movie as well, the whole line between missionary work and cultural imperialism, and how to bring the faith to a culture that doesn't know the faith without at the same time seeking to impose certain cultural expectations. What does Christianity look like in Japan as opposed to what it looks like in Europe?
This is a very interesting question, isn't it? And this is where the Vatican II debate comes in and becomes very complicated, because the attempt in the 1960s to acknowledge the diversity of the faith, I think, was very, very well intentioned, but ironically, actually ended up becoming quite prescriptive, because it's my understanding that prior to Vatican II, there are many variants of rites. And if you look at art and culture from Catholic missions and Catholic countries prior to the 1960s, you do see a diversity in representations of Christ. It's always to a Westerner slightly amusing to see Korean depictions of a Korean Jesus Christ. But why not? Because certainly our European depiction of Jesus is deeply inaccurate. So there is that interesting question of how do you explain something to people, something which is really very alien, but speaks to a universal truth, but needs to be understood on their own terms. And the film does imply that it might be being misunderstood. On the other hand, when the Japanese encounter the Jesuits, it's very clear that they understand the basics. They understand the fundamentals of doctrine. They understand, I need to be christened, I need to be received into the church, I need to have my sins heard, and I need to receive the Eucharist. They understand the essentials, and that's because those are universal.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the things, arguments that is made in trying to get them to apostatize, I think maybe even from Father Ferreira, who I think is played by Liam Neeson in the film, is that the so-called explosion of Christianity in Japan was really an illusion, that it was more syncretic, that they basically just kind of overlaid Christianity on top of their Shinto or Buddhist beliefs. And so, yes. That whole question of how deeply the gospel really penetrated.
But the question is unanswered as to whether or not Father Ferreira is lying.
Right.
He might be lying. That might be his, because to explain to those who haven't read the book or seen the film, at that point he's trying to convince his fellow Jesuit to apostatize. So it's possible he's not telling the truth. It also should be said that God is universal to everyone. He's there even when the church isn't there yet. If there are elements in other faiths which speak to God, that is a reflection of the divine genius in everyone. It makes perfect sense to me personally that a Shintoist could hear elements of Christianity and see it reflected in his own religion, because his own religion is in part constructed upon the human conscience, and that itself is authored by God. And in culture after culture, you have a search for the divine. You have a sense of morality. So it's hardly a surprise that there are things awaiting Christianity which can make some connection with it. So I don't. But I can understand why that argument is very useful for the Japanese to say, look. But also, again, it's rooted in class. Essentially, the argument is these people are too stupid to understand Christianity. And actually, the evidence on screen is quite the opposite. That without even without the priest there, they have maintained the traditions with a faithfulness which implies they understand them.
Well, you're only whetting my appetite to see the film, so hopefully it'll be available here in our little backwater area sometime soon. Let's shift gears. We've got about 4 minutes left or so. I want to ask you, of course, we're sitting 10 days away from the inauguration of President Trump, which are words I still can't believe I'm uttering out of my mouth. what are you expecting from the early months of a Trump presidency?
I'm expecting a bonfire of executive orders. I'm expecting 100 days of Donald Trump to announce things that he is no longer going to be doing. Environmental regulations thrown out, everything that he's signed up to, limits on drilling, for instance, in the Atlantic. I think there's going to be a lot of activity like that. There's going to be a lot of rallies. There's going to be a lot of surprise announcements. I mean, there's going to be activity on building the wall. That's going to matter. Activity in terms of diplomacy with China and with Russia. I predict confidently that his first visit overseas will be to Great Britain. Although it's notable that the Prime Minister of Great Britain is already booked in to go and visit him. He might also visit Israel. I think it's going to be dynamic, and I think it's going to dominate the news. The really interesting question for me is, will he give up his Twitter account, or at least hand it over to him? Because he's going to have two. He'll have both the President of the United States, which presumably will be an entirely formal one, but he'll also retain his personal one. And I really do think it's become a problem. You cannot have the President of the United States having a catfight with Meryl Streep over Twitter. You can't do it.
But, you know, here's the thing, Tim, okay? And I find it appalling, of course. But I think if you look at it in terms of purely politically and strategically, he wins those exchanges. I mean, Meryl Streep is not convincing anybody. I mean, that is for Trump. And it's sort of like, you know, if you get engaged with somebody who that is their preferred medium, then, it's a disaster.
Yes. And one thing I do find refreshing about Trump and that I'm getting used to and learning to live with is that he exposes people's hypocrisy because he doesn't back down. Presidents in the past would either have ignored Meryl Streep or would have essentially said, "I'm sorry," and rolled over. Part of me does have to respect the fact that he replies with sheer vindictiveness. because Meryl Streep personally may well be committed to helping disabled people and helping disabled people in her industry. But her industry is one of the most discriminatory and prejudiced industries in America. There are no disabled people on screen. There was a study that found that 95% of the roles of disabled people on TV are played by able-bodied people. Is that not a form of blackface? That's deeply hypocritical. To attack Trump for misrepresenting disabled people and then to work in an industry which does that on a routine basis, I find that deeply hypocritical, and I do quite sneakily like the fact that something about Trump exposes other people's flaws.
It will be a wildly entertaining. I mean, his inaugural address, his first State of the Union, must see TV.
Absolutely. It's going to be great. He'll keep on telling us it's going great while he's doing it.
That's exciting.
This is a great inaugural. One of the best inaugurals I've ever seen.
Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you for taking time, and really appreciate your great work and your witness for the faith and everything
Thank
as
you.
Well. So blessings to you in the new year, and maybe we'll talk again down the road.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be back in a minute with a new hour. If you want to chime in with a comment or a question, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.